Welcome to Risk Revolution, a podcast series that examines all aspects of risk management in the life sciences industry. We'll talk to industry experts on best practices for identifying risk, assessing risk, measuring solutions, implementing solutions, and monitoring results. Here are your hosts, Nuala Kalnin, Valerie Mulholland, and Lori Richter.
Welcome back to Risk Revolution, our monthly series seeking to advance the maturity of risk management practices across the life sciences sector. We cover topics that challenge professionals within the biopharmaceutical and medtech industries and aim to shake up the paradigm to revolutionize the ways in which we perceive and proactively manage risk. So Nuala is missing for this episode. We are very much missing her today. But Val, welcome to the end of 2025. This is our final episode. And today we're going to explore something coming our way in 2026. Take it away, Val.
Yeah, excuse me. So today we're diving into something that I think will quietly but significantly move the dial on quality risk management, QRM, in pharma operations in 26 and beyond. Today we're going to chat about the recently issued draft revision of the EU GMP Chapter 1. Which is now aligned with our old buddy, ICHQ9R1. But before we unpack and discuss the details, Laurie, I might just take our listeners through the background here. I mean, the revision didn't come out of nowhere. The GMP-GDP Inspectors Working Group in the European Medicines Agency, the EMA, they formally recommended updating Chapter 1 to reflect the changes that were introduced in the 2023 update of ICHQ9R1. And we can share the link to the proposed update to Chapter 1 in the show notes so everybody can look at the proposed changes. And I think the driver here is their ability that the GMP inspectors see on the ground in the application of QRM, and indeed, I think possibly even more with KM, with knowledge management in regulated companies. And for myself, having facilitated a PICS training event for GMP inspectors on risk-based decision making, I know that they will appreciate this revision. So by revising Chapter 1 to mirror ICHQ9R1, in a way, the EU is solidifying risk management principles as auditable regulatory requirements for any company that is supplying its market. And that's an important thought, which I think we should come back to. But first, let me finish the background. So the European Commission, together with the EMA and PICS, launched a stakeholders consultation for this revision in September just gone, and the closing date for comments was the 3rd of December. So many industry organisations and companies have offered their comments and feedback. Personally, I don't think there will be any significant changes from the comments, but who knows? Who knows? So I'll just highlight and summarise here for our listeners that maybe the four, you know, big game changers, which we can see here. And I'm not even sure they are game changers, but the four changes we see. First, it's clear that the update is promoting proactive QRM. I think the proposed changes formally integrate a proactive life cycle based approach to QRM, I suppose, elevating it from a supporting CAS tool to a strategic requirement for our PQS systems. Secondly, I think the draft introduces drug shortage prevention or product availability, as they refer to it in the EU, as a formal responsibility of the PQS. And I think there's an explicit link now between product availability and patient safety and quality oversight, and the definition of risk to quality is expanded to include supply interruptions. And moving this from a guidance into an auditing standard is, I also think it is significant. Thirdly, and some might see this as a new expectation, the update requires manufacturers to establish early warning systems by combining knowledge management and quality risk management to anticipate and respond to evolving quality and manufacturing risks, including, as I already said, product shortages. But that's not really a new expectation. ICHQ 10 spoke to this back in, when was it, Laurie, 2008? Section 3.2.1, to be specific, in case anyone's checking up on our fact finding here. And finally, and I think this is quite significant as well, there is a pretty explicit enhancement and clarification of requirements for the product quality review, or the PQR, as we call it here in Europe, particularly for products where there was limited or no manufacturing activity during the review period. And it also establishes some new criteria for grouping products within these reviews. So there are the big ticket items. So where to start? What about with proactive QRM? Because we know this has been a documented concern for a long time. So, Laurie, what do you see as the weak spots that this update may address?
Yeah, I think for one, I was quite happy to see when I went through and reviewed the document where they addressed those QRM elements. I like that, as always, they left some level of interpretation there. But, or and I should say, it's still in the regs, right? And I think that's the important part, is the expectation is there for that proactive piece, but it's not super prescriptive about how you're going to make that happen. And I always love having that flexibility in there and also having that expectation in there, if that makes sense. In fact, in reviewing the entire document, and we'll talk about it a little bit later, the PQR part was where it most pres was very prescriptive, which was actually quite helpful, especially if you're not continuously manufacturing and you need to do that piece of work. But back to the proactive piece, I hope it addresses some of those things around the decision making, that really there is a place for that reactive risk element that's in there. I think we see it with investigations, CAPAs, deviations. We sometimes have that reactive piece that's almost proactive when it's looking forward to something that actually happened. Now that this thing has happened, how do we prevent that from happening elsewhere, even though it's also in and of itself an issue because it's been realized, if you will. I think that pushing that proactive piece is where you really get the bang for the buck, right? In the QRM, sorry, in the QMS piece of it. It's really where risk gives us so much to work with in terms of informing us for our decision making, helping us to tie in that knowledge management piece. So I'm hoping that that drives home that there's a lot of benefit here. I am in so many conversations where, when we're trying to make a decision at whatever company I'm at, we often talk about risk without saying the word risk sometimes, and we don't always write them down. So we're always having these conversations, we're always doing these things proactively. We're forgetting to write that stuff down with our rationale for our decisions, which I think really drives home the knowledge management piece again. But I'll turn it over to you again. I think that there was some great benefit in some of the things that I saw, and I like how it was still giving you some flexibility in how to accomplish those elements too.
Yeah, I agree with you because, you know, sometimes when I'm in companies, I do think sometimes that QRM operates too mechanic, oh, you know, too process driven. You know, there isn't enough thought going into it. There isn't enough, as you say, flexibility going into it. It's using very standardized risk models, standardized tools, standardized, you know, and sometimes even the risks and hazards being evaluated are pre-selected. It can seem very performative at times, and dare I say it, even unauthentic sometimes, you know. And also, I think current tools tend to resolve risk to single point estimates, which is something that can be quite worrying, rather than consider perhaps a more realistic distribution of outcomes, you know, that there's a range of outcomes possible here. And so I think operations don't always prepare for the edge cases then in their risk scenarios, and maybe aren't always addressing uncertainty as to exactly where the risk controls and the risk management might land, you know. I often think when we reflect on that QRM diagram that we're all highly familiar with, I hope, in ICHQ 9 and or 1, you know, following risk analysis, there is that little box risk evaluation. I don't know, do we use that as much as we should, you know? And I do think we need to, you know, evaluate the output of risk analysis with, you know, the mindset of a detective. Look beyond the scoring at the scenarios that the real operation may face, and the the real problems that may show up. If risk only shows up for evaluation or analysis after an issue has occurred, I think you're studying history there, not risk management, So I think there are blind spots in QRM, and sometimes are they the risk in themselves, And perhaps these are the scenarios that then that potentially trigger drug shortages because we didn't plan adequately for this scenario. And that was the second proposed update to Chapter 1. No, I must add, there was an existing requirement in Chapter 5 to report to competent authorities potential shortages due to manufacturing constraints. But Chapter 1 seems to go beyond that and states that, QRM should be considered for risk-based shortage prevention and mitigation, including, it notes product availability risk with suppliers or CMOs or service providers, etc. So it sounds like the dial is moving from, risks we might become aware of and therefore need to inform that there's a potential issue coming down the line to something we actively need to manage, and that's a big adjacent hook into supply chain and good distribution practice. And, maybe I could even call that a fifth change out of the update because I think shortage prevention has been pulled into the PQS conversation as something auditable, not aspirational. And I don't know, Laurie, what do you think? Is it fair to ask the manufacturing site to be responsible for a challenge that is so multifactorial and where causation could be spread along a very complex supply chain? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean that's a complex issue, and I know one of our research colleagues, Emma Ramnarayan, she called drug shortages a wicked problem, and I actually referenced her her work in my thesis, my PhD thesis as well, which a wicked problem is defined as something that's difficult, if not impossible, to solve due to its complex, interconnected, and changing nature. So, what you're talking about is sort of managing that wicked problem. Is that fair for a site to do that, given the complexity? And I guess I would argue back about that. It's interesting. I interpreted ICHQ9, the original version, as actually talking about that at the time. But I noticed in the industry, we sort of toggled back and forth as to whether supply was really covered in that scope. And then, of course, when R1 came out, it really drove it home that, availability was part of that. And I guess I would argue back too, Val, that it's just good business to make sure that if you're going to manufacture something, you can continue to supply that to the customer. And I think in pharma, it's even more critical. I myself am on medications for a kidney transplant. If I can't get my medications, I'm in a lot of trouble here. So I'm hoping that my manufacturers, and I'm sure there are several at this point, they're generic now, are also considering those things. So I guess I would argue it is fair. Now, at a site level versus maybe a large corporate level, those things need to be evaluated differently. But I'd like to think that this is a place where quality is the business, and that in order to be able to meet the quality needs, which means I should be able to supply that to my patient whose life may be dependent, if it's medically necessary, if there's no competitor on the market, I think it's just good business if I'm responsible for that. So I would argue yes. And I know several years ago in the US, that responsibility was also placed on the FDA to be accountable for that supply chain as well, because we've had many problems, as you can attest to as well in your own experiences, that supply has been an issue for a lot of us. Many times there's holds placed on something, there's manufacturing issues, they can't distribute that product. And these are products that are critical to patients. So, yes, I do think that we need to take that accountability, and I just think that makes good business sense. If I run a lemonade stand and I can't supply lemons, I'm going to have problems. Right? So,
You make a very compelling case there, Lorian. Somebody has to start. The responsibility and accountability, I like the word you use there, has to start somewhere, because, product availability is a very, very real risk. My use case now is nowhere as serious or as compelling as yours, but last year, I will share this with the listeners. I had an eye infection, and I went into the pharmacy for over-the-counter eye drops. And they were, no, they were all in shortage, impossible to get, and I stood there, said to the pharmacist, who looked very sympathetic now, and I said, what'll I do? And he asked me, have you tried cucumbers? And I'm going, what? I think he was suggesting I chop up a cucumber and put them on my eyes. Now, I was a miles away from anything I think cucumbers could have helped with. But, I was fortunate. I was able to go to my GP and get a prescription for a prescription, an RX version of the treatment. And so, I was sorted, but it did prompt me to closely examine the drug shortage list in Ireland at the time. And I was particularly going through looking for products where there was no alternative, because on the list they were suggesting alternative medicines that might help. And Laurie, there were examples there like anti-epilepsy drugs for children. Can you imagine the stress of a family challenged with those medical concerns, knowing there's a medication that can help, but it's not available, and nor are any alternates. They're very real problems. And so, yeah, I agree with you. A regulatory focus is important. And so maybe that leads into the third area of focus, which is having those early warning signals. And I hear that question increasingly in regulatory inspections. What was the earliest indicator that this of this problem, and could you have found it, sooner, further back in the supply chain, or did you not react sooner? Or, if you find your problem on finished testing, could you found the problem in process testing? If you find the problem in process testing, could you found it at incoming inspection? That challenging further back the supply chain all the time, and this draft explicitly states that KM and QRM, should be working together to design and provide early warning systems for risk, including risks related to product availability. So I think regulators are expecting, or will be expecting, us to do more than collect data. We must be able to spot weak signals, and act before they become deviations or shortages. And I noted that the draft, seems to broaden out what counts as an early indicator. So things like unexpected supplier variability or maintenance and asset reliability patterns, cleaning issues, recurrent deviations, stability or environmental trends, being wobbly, or capacity issues, or including external dependency, as I mentioned, risks that come to us externally that can impact our availability. In other words, anything that indicates an emerging risk to quality or availability is now part of our signal detection kit. And this is where tools like the bow tie, I think, are very valuable. I know Nuala and I were, almost evangelistic about getting maybe the bow tie added into ICHQ9 or 1, and I certainly would love to see that tool used more widely. But anyway, that thought of early signal detection, well, what are you thinking, Laurie?
Yeah, well, one, I just want to comment on the cucumber thing. I was hoping that your pharmacist was not actually offering you a spa treatment for
Oh, I might
or
have
maybe
missed that early signal,
that,
Laurie, if he was.
right. Maybe that was a comment. I don't know. But if that is an alternative to what you were facing, maybe it was cheaper too. I don't
Perhaps,
know.
true that, true that.
But I do want to respond on the signals and such. One, I think it's great that knowledge management was integrated in there. Just the use of that and seeing it together with risk management, which we know we're very familiar with in ICHQ10, but seeing those now in that reg group together, I think must be a gift to someone like Marty Lippa, who's been who's been on that fight. So the second piece is, I think what I see sometimes when I look at regs like that, or things that are put into the regs that are worded in that way, I always try to look at what's behind that. What drove that to be there? And I almost feel like it's one of those things where the agencies are telling us, stop firefighting, start being proactive about what you're doing, right? We know you're capable of doing that. You're sitting on gobs of data that give you the ability to analyze and proactively look at these things. Stop that reactive behavior that you're in, right? So I kind of interpret it on a broader scale as, why was that put in there? What was sort of behind the scenes that pushed that? And I love it. I love that they're sort of telling us, you already have the data, you have a lot of the capability. Are you using it to drive the decisions? And I think you and I both know that that does not happen very often. We concoct many, many things we want to look at. And sometimes our QSMRs and our trend reports, they get so big and nebulous. I think we get lost in how much data we can collect that we forget to actually look at the critical pieces to drive decisions proactively, right? We don't get to that end stage because we're so, oh, we can collect this. Well, what else can I collect? And you know, when you start presenting sometimes to senior leadership, their first comments are, can we look at this or that? Can we dissect it this way? Can we cut the data that way? Which is fine if you're actually going to do something with it. What am I going to do if that thing's red? What am I going to do if I trigger that limit? What's the action I'm going to take? We kind of halt at the, can I analyze it, right? What is it going to tell me? So I think that's critical. And I think back to your comment about the supplier issues. I'm sorry, but I think we need to tackle that one huge, especially in the US. We have got to manage that a lot better. That's been an ongoing problem in terms of providing raw materials and supporting drugs and causing sometimes problems with drug shortages. We are in a global market and we have got to work together better somehow, all of us, right, to make sure that we're managing those supply issues. I don't know what the answers are. I'm not suggesting that I have that, but I think that's just going to be an ongoing problem that we're all going to keep sort of fighting about if we don't address that one head on. That was a
Yeah,
lot.
because our
That was a long
patients are
answer.
durable. Yeah, it was
Yes.
actually.
Yes. And
Yeah.
everybody, look, everybody deserves to have access, right, to that treatment.
Yeah.
Back to your comments about the, I can't even imagine what some people go through. When I see drug shortages, my heart hurts because I don't know how people are managing some of that. My goodness, here in the US, just not even 2 years ago, we had issues with IV fluids in hospitals. Patients couldn't even get the access to
Correct.
fluids they needed for surgeries. So, I mean, we have got to manage this better. We can't have one single warehouse in the middle of Tornado Alley that's storing all of our stuff. I mean, that's part of risk management and your supply continuity. So,
Back to the point, I suppose, of seeing beyond the data, you know, seeing that these aren't just graphs and charts and mini tabs and you know, they're people, and there's meaning behind these things, and you know, we need to look beyond those data. And when we're talking about interpreting signals, I mean, you know, that's a very, very weighted and meaningful comment, you know. So anyway, which brings us to our third requirement, I think, which I don't know, was this particularly ICHQ9 related? But Laurie, I think you've some thoughts of this, which was the, you know, enhanced clarity around the product quality review, that annual review we do. And, you know, I saw kind of explicitly two clarifications at least there. One was that the PQR must be prepared even when no batches are manufactured, you know.
Yes, I found that fascinating.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know historically some sites skipped PQRs if production paused or was campaigned or whatever, but I think that loophole is now closed. And I suppose the implication is we'll now need to analyze, you know, what data there is, stability data, complaints, recalls, trends, supplier issues, as you said, because we do plan to make it in the future. Even capacity, reliability, availability, you know, even in those zero batch years. And the second change I spotted is that grouping is now recognised, but with new constraints. You know, the draft allows grouping of similar products, but, you know, has applied some warnings on it, you know, particularly against using representative products only. And, you know, my impression was it's unacceptable now to do a PQR on one SKU and claim it covers everything else, or use a single batch as a proxy for multiple presentations. So grouping without justification, I don't think so. I think what we're looking at is a documented rationale for grouping that makes sense, scientific sense, evidence that group products, I guess, have genuinely similar risk profiles, and data from all products considered, not just one token batch and one token example, you know. But one thing I also noted is that the PQR doesn't seem to be viewed as a, you know, just a retrospective annual report. You know, I got the sense it's been redefined as part of that feedback loop of the PQS, you know, looking to generate forward-looking actions. I think the expectation is it'll be produced decisions and not just summaries and, oh, yes, everything's all right, you know, but that it's forward-looking, not backward-looking. What did you think?
I love that. So I love that section. Was I a little bit concerned about the level of prescriptive, you know, instruction it had in there? Sure. But honestly, I spent some time in the rare disease space, it does make it difficult sometimes to understand what do I do if I've only maybe produced two batches in 2 years or something time frame. It kind of helps you sort of understand what to do with that. I have always wanted PQR to be something more than I think it was seen as in the industry. I do think it was seen as sort of the summary report. Okay, these are the things that happened, and we looked at this, and we did this because the regulations sort of require us, and now we have it ready for auditors kind of thing. I hate doing stuff like that, to be quite honest with you. I think there's so much quality system elements have to offer for the business that I just love seeing this pushed now more as a, this is actually going to help you. It's this nice review, retrospective review. It is to help you look ahead. Right. Okay. What did we see in the last year? If it's, you know, you got to combine some batches or whatever, maybe it's 18 months, whatever, that makes us think about our strategy moving forward. What should we change? What should we do differently, if anything? Right. I love seeing that introduced more as a business tool and not a checkbox audit requirement. I did it. Yay for me. I summarize. And you all look, we know how much work this takes. Okay. At some companies, they have people fully dedicated to PQR
Absolutely,
reporting.
Yeah.
Right. And I think they must be celebrating because they're like, hey, look, my work has meaning. Right. Because it always did and always should have. But I think this highlights the importance that it can bring to the business. So I'm excited about that element. Okay, maybe some people are going to disagree with me. Feel free to leave your comments. I'm open to that too, because I haven't had to put it in practice right yet. But I think this is going to be a welcome change. What are your thoughts, though? I don't want to, maybe you think
No, I agree. You know, I think the suggestion there is that, you know, it must evolve from that annual report to a living risk knowledge tool, you know. That, you know, the trending turns into action and management decision making. So for sure. And you know, I think its role historically has been somewhat, I mean, Professor O'Donnell used to always say, you know, it's too late by the time you see something in your PQR, your annual review. You know, you need to be more current than that. So by elevating its role now to something that is, you know, driving things forward by taking large data sets and looking at what they mean, again, you know, going beyond that analysis to evaluate, you know, I think that could make that quite a powerful tool, actually. And it'd be interesting to see what they do and how they look at this when they're actually on sites. Because, Laurie, this is one worry I have about the update, right? Okay, I'm going to be frank here, you know. Because ICHQ 901 really shows up in this update, you know, and three things really stand out in particular. You know, it's looking for formality to match the level of risk. It's talking, it brings in that topic of subjectivity and asks that it be managed and minimized, and, you know, that risk decisions must be reviewed in the light of new knowledge. And I'm so excited that those things are there. And I agree with each of them as a requirement, but I do have a concern about moving them from the guidance, from the ICH guidance, into the EU GMP inspection standard. Because, for example, by making formality an explicit requirement, has a new auditing hook effectively been created? You know, my concern is simple. I think instead of focusing on the risk and on being proportionate in how we react to that risk, I worry we'll end up defending the level of formality we chose. And let's be honest, no inspector's ever going to cite a company for being too formal, even though the text proposed in Chapter 1 is designed to encourage that and to encourage proportionality. So I think the intention is good. You know, it gives organisations permission to scale their QRM effort in terms of the, you know, the level of risk. But that was already there. That statement about proportionality was already there. But intention and guidance is one thing. You know, interpretation during inspections is another. Once formality becomes auditable, I fear that the safest plan for companies would be to create a procedure to standardise it. And once we do that, the procedure then becomes the target. You know, will the conversation shift from did we manage the risk to did we follow the formality framework as it is in the procedure? And my worry is that by making it auditable, we'll shift from managing risk to defending the paperwork. It's the classic paradox, isn't it? A requirement meant to reduce unnecessary bureaucracy may end up creating a whole new layer of it. So I think this detail may aid inspectors, and I know it will, and I know it's something they were struggling with out in the field. So, you know, I think, and I can see why this clarification is important to them, but I think companies might rather it was left in the guidance and that flexibility and discretion. And you brought up flexibility at the start, you know, that's preserved. So we'll be watching the consultation feedback closely. But, you know, what do you think? This draft is really pushing the industry forward in this space. So it's up to all of us to jump, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, maybe, and I think it does go back to your mindset. You bring up such a good point, Val, because when I looked at those edits, I was excited. I was like, oh, this is great. It kept it general enough, but it drove home the things that I think those of us that are fans of Q9 want to see. And there's that flip side, though, that you talk about, which is that err on the side of conservative is if I see something, oh, gosh, now I'm going to have to write that maybe I make a statement every risk assessment. We managed the subjectivity, you know, and sign that. Right. We don't want to see that level of, you know, complexity added to our risk assessments. I like to view it with it opened things up and gave us opportunity, but also pushed the concept of risk management, because I think that's great. But if it drives it to be more conservative and, oh, I'm going to err on the side of FMEA because now there's this, you know, spectrum in there and I don't want to be too loose on that. So I'm just going to drive home the most complex tool because nobody's going to say. I will say I have been in an inspection where a health authority actually commented, your QMS is way too complicated. It is not sustainable. But they never wrote an observation for it. So you're right. They won't do that, but they'll tell you that they think it's unsustainable for your business, right? So I hope that those, it brings good things to the industry, but I hope we also don't overreact. And that is what we tend to do. So we'll see.
Because, you know, over here in Europe, we have the role of the QP, the qualified person, who tends to make a lot of these decisions or the decision accountability and responsibility ends up with them, you know. And very many of them have what I call frozen syndrome. In other words, you know, they can't let it go in terms of formality, you know. And lower formality is something that they really struggle with because, you know, they come back to the question, what if I'm asked about this in inspection? And, you know, would that be okay? You know, I want to show I was really rigorous about this. So it is hard to let it go, you know. So yeah, that is a concern, but we'll see how it pans out.
And I would argue back too that I've seen plenty of FMEAs that were indefensible because they just weren't. It's like, what's happening here? Why did you even use this complex
tool? They were
tool?
Overcooked.
Right. It's like, I don't even know what decisions you were trying to drive from that. So, you know, the exact opposite can happen too. But I also appreciate the role of the QP and do understand that level of concern, you know, too. So on that note, not that we want to end on a we'll see, but I think we'll see, meaning that this could be really great. Let's leave 2025 kind of behind us. We've only got a few days left here. A year where we saw a lot of change, I think, especially in the US, on lots of fronts. And it looks like 2026 is going to continue in that vein. I think there's some really great things coming. I'm already seeing, especially in the industry, seems like more cash flow. So I'm hoping and highly optimistic for pharma and 2026 to kind of rebound from a little bit of a slump that it got into this year in the last couple of years to maybe really progressing forward. To our regular listeners, a big thank you. Our producer, Ben, who is awesome and fabulous and is always on the call with us, has told us that you've really shown up a lot this year and our numbers are really great. So we hope that you continue. To new listeners, excuse me, welcome. Make us your top pod in 2026 so that we can keep talking about all these topics. Send us comments. We always appreciate that. And please don't miss an episode. I just really want to thank Ben. He always sticks with us, even though we just ramble on. So, so thank you. Thank you to Ben. He always does an amazing and fabulous job. And
yeah,
before
absolutely.
We go, what's in the show notes, Val?
Oh, the show notes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, I'll just echo, we make 2026 everybody's New Year's risk resolution. What do you think of it? Yeah.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Isn't that a good one?
Yeah.
Anyway, the show notes. So I was only going to share one link, really, which was the link to the proposed update so people could keep an eye on that, because any minute now the comments from industry are going to be posted and we can see what the reaction was. It won't be just you and me, Laurie. But now that you mentioned it, I might also share the links to Emma's work on wicked problems, because I think that's relevant here as well. And perhaps, because you mentioned it as well, Marty Lippa's work on connecting QRM and KM, because I think they're very, very good reads as well. So happy reading there to everybody, and happy new year from me, Val.
Happy new year from Laurie. Thank you.